He thought it was harmless, a mechanic, two casual dates. But by the time Carrie Farver disappeared, Dave Krupa's life became a four-year nightmare. He started receiving thousands of eerie texts and emails, threatening messages supposedly from Carrie herself, while his home was vandalized, and even Shauna Liz Golyer's house burned down, killing her pets. It all felt like a twisted game. Until years later, detectives uncovered a chilling truth. Those messages weren't from Carrie. They were from her killer, framing herself as the victim. Online dating had pulled all three into a cycle of deception, stalking, arson, and murder. Now, dive deep into a case where digital footprints became tragic clues, and obsession led to homicide. So, if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. A Quiet Life, a New Beginning. In 2012, Dave Krupa was trying to start over. Recently, out of a long-term relationship and adjusting to life as a single father of two, Dave had moved to Omaha, Nebraska, to take a new job managing an auto repair shop. His days were busy, structured, work, parenting, and not much else. He wasn't looking for love, just a connection, something easy. He turned to online dating. The simplicity appealed to him. No pressure, no expectations. It was just a way to meet people. That's where he matched with a woman named Shauna Golyer, who introduced herself simply as Liz. Liz was energetic, chatty, and confident. A single mother herself, she and Dave hit it off quickly. They bonded over motorcycles, horror movies, and mutual respect for each other's independence. From the beginning, they agreed. This was casual, no commitments, no drama. But that dynamic shifted just a few weeks later. One afternoon, a woman named Carrie Farver walked into Dave's repair shop, needing work done on her SUV. She had striking features, a kind smile, and a sharp, no-nonsense way of speaking. Dave noticed her instantly. Later that same day, he saw her on the dating app he used and sent her a message. To his surprise, she replied. Their first date was effortless. Carrie was funny, driven, and refreshingly direct. She was a case. She was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison with an additional 18 to 20 years for arson. Even then, she maintained her innocence. Dave Krupa never returned to the man he once was. He left the dating world, became more private, guarded. For years, he lived under the shadow of a woman he thought was his girlfriend and another who pretended to be her. Amy Flora, who also suffered years of harassment, broke down during the trial, finally able to grieve and breathe again. And Kari's mother, Nancy Rainey, who never stopped fighting for the truth, sat silently as the verdict was read. Relief etched across her face, but no celebration, because her daughter was still gone. Carrie Farver had been a mother, a daughter, a skilled professional. She had dreams. She had routines. She didn't vanish. She was taken. And for four long years, her voice had been hijacked, her identity abused by someone who wanted to erase her and nearly succeeded. But in the end, the truth broke through, and all it took was one photo. Chapter 5, Inside the Mind of Liz Golyer. Shauna Elizabeth Golyer was, on the surface, unremarkable. She was a single mother, lived in the Omaha area, and worked a string of everyday jobs. She smiled easily. She chatted with neighbors. She posted online like anyone else. Family photos, everyday frustrations, the occasional inspirational quote. But beneath that surface was a person capable of something most can't even imagine. Murdering a woman she barely knew, stealing her identity, and using it to construct a 4-year campaign of digital terror so convincing it fooled everyone around her. After her conviction, investigators began to look deeper, not just at her actions, but at her patterns. What kind of person could live a double life like that? What kind of mind could fake victimhood for years while secretly orchestrating the crime? They began to find pieces, clues, breadcrumbs that in hindsight painted a picture of a master manipulator hiding in plain sight. Liz's relationships had always been complicated. She'd had several romantic entanglements, many of which ended in conflict. Friends described her as controlling, possessive, prone to jealousy. She had a way of inserting herself into situations that didn't directly involve her, especially when it came to men she was interested in. One former friend recalled an incident years before the murder. Liz had begun dating someone new. When he started pulling away, strange things started happening. Anonymous texts, vandalism, and even reports of threats sent to people close to him. The pattern mirrored what later happened to Dave Krupa, but no one had looked closely then. No one had connected the dots, because Liz always played the victim, and she was good at it. Psychologists later studying her case would point to traits consistent with narcissistic personality disorder: an inflated sense of self-importance, a deep need for admiration, and a complete lack of empathy for others. But Liz's behaviors went beyond that. She demonstrated traits of pathological lying, creating entire realities that didn't exist, maintaining them for years, and adjusting them on the fly when challenged. She didn't just want Dave Krupa's affection. She wanted control. Control over his relationships, his time, his emotions. And when Carrie Farver entered the picture, Liz saw a threat, not just to her access to Dave, but to her sense of power. Carrie was intelligent, independent, emotionally stable, all the things Liz feared she was not. So she removed her, not just physically, but digitally, socially, and psychologically. She became Carrie Farver, and in doing so, Liz believed she could erase the competition and step into the role she thought she deserved. But when Dave didn't fall for her the way she'd imagined, when he kept her at arm's length and refused to commit, her obsession turned to revenge. If she couldn't have him, no one could. What makes Liz's story even more terrifying is how methodical she was. She didn't lash out in rage. She planned. She studied. She adapted. She created over 30 fake email accounts to harass Dave, Amy, and others. She programmed calendar reminders to send herself fake threats so she could find them and report them. She used virtual private networks and disposable phones. She even sent herself abusive messages to convince police she was being stalked. In one instance, Liz texted herself from a fake Kari account, then ran barefoot into a police station, claiming she was being followed. Officers were so disturbed by her performance that they escorted her home. It wasn't until much later that they discovered she had parked her own car around the corner and staged the entire event. It was all theater, all manipulation, all designed to keep suspicion away from her and keep Dave's attention pointed in her direction. Experts reviewing the case called it one of the most sophisticated examples of digital identity abuse they had ever seen. Liz's ability to mimic Carrie's voice through text, through email, through photos was disturbingly accurate. She studied Kari's social media presence. She mimicked her spelling and tone. She even sent emails to Carrie's own mother, pretending to be her daughter just to keep the illusion alive. It was more than obsession. It was erasure. Liz didn't just want Carrie gone. She wanted her to exist only through the lens she created. A stalker, a psycho, a dangerous woman no one should ever trust. In doing so, Liz crafted a villain out of her victim and played the role of survivor so well, most believed her, until the evidence spoke for itself. What's most haunting about the Liz Goliar case isn't just the murder. It's the performance that followed. For 4 years, Liz lived inside a lie of her own making. She controlled the narrative, influenced the investigation, manipulated everyone around her, and almost got away with it. She didn't wear a mask. She didn't run. She didn't disappear. She stayed close. She kept inserting herself into Dave's life, into police reports, into courtrooms, confident that no one would see the truth. But the truth has a way of resurfacing. And in Liz's case, all it took was one cracked digital trail. And the patience of a few investigators who refused to believe the story everyone else had accepted. Chapter 6, The Trial of Shauna Liz Goliar. The courtroom in Sarpy County, Nebraska, was unusually quiet when the trial began in 2017. There were no screaming headlines, no frenzied camera crews or rows of reporters, just a sense of disbelief among those who followed the case closely. Shauna Liz Goliar was not just on trial for murder. She was on trial for one of the most complex and bizarre digital deception cases in modern history. On the surface, the prosecution had no body, no murder weapon, no eyewitnesses. What they did have, however, was a mountain of digital evidence and the psychological map of a woman who had spent 4 years pretending to be someone she had killed. To win the case, prosecutors would have to take the jury on a journey, not just through technology, but through obsession, manipulation, and the slow unraveling of a lie so large it had consumed the lives of everyone involved. The state began with what they did know. Kari Farver was last seen alive on November 13, 2012. She'd spent the night at Dave Krupa's apartment. That morning, Dave left for work. When he returned later that day, Carrie was gone, completely. No one, not her son, not her mother, not her co-workers, ever saw her again. What followed was a digital firestorm. Thousands of messages, threats, and emails poured into the lives of Dave Krupa, Amy Flora, and even Liz herself. Police had initially assumed the messages were from Carrie. The timeline suggested she was simply unstable and had run off. But prosecutors now revealed the truth. Every one of those emails had been tracked. And many of them, especially the most violent and threatening ones, were traced directly back to Liz Goliar's home network, her workplace Wi-Fi, and most damning of all, her personal devices. In court, the prosecution laid out the sequence. Liz had created at least 30 fake email addresses and social media profiles to impersonate Carrie Farver. She used these to harass multiple people and report attacks on herself. When questioned by police, she provided her own evidence, screenshots, printed emails, even burned objects, as proof of Carrie's behavior. What she didn't realize was that investigators had recovered metadata from the devices she used. For example, one disturbing image showed a woman tied up in a basement. Prosecutors argued it was staged, designed to make it seem like Carrie had kidnapped someone. That photo, they revealed, had been taken in Liz's own garage on her own phone. But the turning point in the trial came when the recovered memory card was entered into evidence. On it, the jury saw images that chilled the room, photos of what appeared to be human remains, partially burned, a foot with a recognizable tattoo on the ankle. It matched the exact design Carrie Farver was known to have. There was no body in a grave, no crime scene in the woods, but there, in a series of grotesque images Liz had tried to erase, was the proof prosecutors needed. She had killed Carrie, and she had kept part of her. Liz's defense team argued that the evidence was circumstantial. They pointed to the lack of physical remains, the absence of a murder weapon, and the fact that no one actually saw a confrontation between the two women. They leaned on the idea that someone else, possibly even Dave or Amy, could have planted the images on Liz's devices. They called her a victim, once again, of a master hacker. They said she had been set up, but prosecutors pushed back hard. They showed the jury timelines, login records, and device traces. They showed how Liz had scheduled messages to arrive at just the right time, how she had pretended to be both victim and stalker, controlling every aspect of the narrative for years. They reminded the jury that Liz had inserted herself into the investigation repeatedly, offering help, supplying false leads, and even showing up at vigils for Carrie, pretending to be concerned. It wasn't just manipulation. It was performance, and it was over. The trial lasted several weeks. Dave Krupa testified. So did Amy Flora. Carrie's mother, Nancy Rainey, sat through every moment, her face quiet but firm. When the jury returned their verdict, there was no outburst, just silence. Shauna Liz Goliar was found guilty of first-degree murder and second-degree arson. The judge sentenced her to life in prison, plus an additional 18 to 20 years for setting her own garage on fire in an effort to frame Carrie. Even after the conviction, Liz never admitted guilt. She maintained her innocence in prison. She filed appeals. She claimed she was wrongfully convicted, but the evidence told a different story. In the aftermath, the case became a benchmark for how digital crimes could escalate into real-world horror. It highlighted how easily someone could steal an identity, use technology to fake an entire life, and manipulate perception so convincingly that even law enforcement believed it. It also raised urgent questions. How did the system fail Carrie Farver for so long? Why wasn't more attention paid when her mother insisted something was wrong? And how many other people have been digitally erased by someone who knew how to hide behind a screen? The courtroom gave Carrie back her name, but the scars left behind for her family, for Dave, for her son, would never fully heal. Chapter 7, Aftermath, Memory, and the Legacy of Carrie Farver. It was over. Shauna Liz Goliar was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. The stalking had stopped. The messages were gone. The shadow that had loomed over Dave Krupa's life for nearly half a decade had finally lifted. But for those who lived through it, the damage remained. No one emerged from the ordeal unchanged. Not Dave, not Amy, and certainly not Carrie's family, who had spent 4 long years begging people to believe something they already knew. Carrie hadn't just disappeared. She had been taken. And now they had proof. Dave Krupa tried to return to a normal life, but normal had changed. He withdrew from dating. His once casual attitude about relationships had turned cautious, even fearful. For years, he had been gaslit into questioning his own reality, chased by a digital ghost, manipulated by a woman pretending to be his ex-girlfriend, and surrounded by chaos he didn't cause. In interviews after the trial, Dave spoke carefully, not angry, not bitter, just tired. He said he still doesn't trust people the way he used to. He still watches his surroundings. He still wakes up sometimes expecting a message. Trauma doesn't always leave bruises. Sometimes it just rewrites how you move through the world. Amy Flora, the mother of Dave's children, had been targeted nearly as viciously as Dave himself. She received hundreds of threatening messages, had her home vandalized, and lived for years believing someone wanted her and her kids dead. She tried to shield her children from it all. But how do you protect your kids from a threat that doesn't have a face? Amy stayed strong throughout the trial. She testified with poise. And when it was finally over, she stepped away from the public eye, focusing on healing and on giving her children the stability they had been denied for years. And then there was Nancy Rainey, Carrie's mother, the woman who never gave up. When everyone said her daughter had left voluntarily, Nancy insisted that wasn't true. When police said Carrie was just angry and unstable, Nancy knew otherwise. She pushed. She documented. She contacted journalists, investigators, and prosecutors. She filed report after report. She kept her daughter's name alive, even when the world moved on. It was Nancy who gave police the tattoo description that led to identifying Carrie's remains. It was Nancy who refused to let Carrie be reduced to a missing person. And it was Nancy who sat silent and steady as the verdict came down, finally giving her daughter the justice she deserved. Even still, she did not celebrate. How do you celebrate a verdict when your daughter is never coming home? Carrie Farver was more than a victim. She was a mother, a software engineer, a friend. She was known for her intelligence, her dry sense of humor, and her kindness. She had dreams, plans, a future. That future was stolen by someone who didn't even know her, someone who saw her as a threat and erased her. What makes this story even more horrifying is how long Carrie's memory was twisted. For years, her identity was used to torment, manipulate, and destroy. Her name became synonymous with violence, danger, and instability. And none of it was her doing. Liz Goliar didn't just take Carrie's life. She tried to take her narrative. And for a time, she succeeded. But the truth has weight. And in the end, it broke through. Since the trial, the case has been studied by law enforcement across the country. It became a warning about the power of digital identities and how easily someone can hijack another person's life with the right tools, the right knowledge, and enough determination. It exposed how the system often fails to take emotional abuse, stalking, and cybercrime seriously until it's too late. And it raised the call for stronger protections against digital impersonation, something far more common than most realize. Because Carrie's case wasn't just about murder. It was about erasure. And that perhaps is the cruelest form of violence. Today, her family keeps her memory alive through interviews, memorials, and advocacy. They remind the world that Carrie was not a villain, not unstable, not a ghost behind a screen. She was a real woman, and she deserved more. Now her story serves as a reminder to believe your instincts, to look deeper, to trust that when something feels off, it probably is, and above all, to never stop asking questions. Because sometimes justice takes years, but it can still come. Even if it starts with one message, even if the truth is buried under thousands of lies. 37-year-old software developer, a single mother, and like Dave, wasn't looking to get tied down. Their chemistry was immediate. Within a week, Carrie began spending nights at Dave's apartment. But that promising new chapter took a dark turn the day Liz unexpectedly showed up. Carrie had stayed over. As she stepped out of Dave's apartment one morning, Liz was standing in the hallway. It was an awkward encounter, tense and silent. Neither woman said much. Dave smoothed things over, or so he thought. A few days later, on the morning of November 13th, Dave left Carrie at his apartment while he went to work. She had an early meeting nearby and planned to leave shortly after him. That was the last time he ever saw her in person. By that afternoon, everything changed. Dave received a text from Carrie, unexpected, intense. She asked if they could move in together. The tone was completely different from their usual banter. He responded that they were moving too fast and reminded her of their agreement to keep things casual. Then came the messages, not just one or two, but dozens, then hundreds. Kari seemed angry, erratic, accusatory. The tone grew darker. You ruined my life. You'll regret this. The messages poured in, day after day. Dave assumed she was having a breakdown, or maybe just venting in the aftermath of rejection. But Carrie was gone. Her phone number still worked. Messages kept coming. But she wasn't showing up to work. She wasn't picking up her son from school. Her mother hadn't seen her. Her friends couldn't reach her. To the people who knew Carrie best, something felt wrong. Police initially believed she had left on her own. There was no sign of foul play, and the texts made it seem like she was still out there, angry, unstable, but alive. Then the threats began. The messages weren't just sent to Dave. They reached his ex-girlfriend, Amy. They targeted his co-workers, his friends, even Liz. One night, Dave came home to find that someone had broken into his apartment. Nothing was taken, but his belongings had been moved, rearranged. Another time, Liz reported that someone had slashed her tires. Then her garage was set on fire, killing her pets. Through it all, the messages continued, thousands of them, emails from different accounts, texts from random numbers, social media messages that popped up under strange aliases. They all had the same voice, angry, obsessive, and fixated on destroying Dave's life. He changed his phone number. They still found him. He moved apartments. They still knew where he was. He started looking over his shoulder wherever he went, wondering if he was being watched. It became impossible to sleep, impossible to trust. At times, he even began to doubt himself. Was Kari truly behind all of this, or was someone pretending to be her? But why would anyone go to such lengths? And if Kari really was missing, who was sending these messages? That was the puzzle law enforcement had no idea they were already in the middle of. To them, it was a routine missing persons report. No body, no crime. But behind the scenes, something far more sinister had already begun. The woman everyone thought had disappeared was not the one tormenting Dave. In fact, the truth was even darker than anyone imagined. And by the time investigators caught on, it would be too late to save Carrie Farver. Chapter 2, The Woman Behind the Curtain. The messages didn't stop. They multiplied. Dave Krupa, once living a quiet life in Omaha, now woke up to dozens of threatening texts before his coffee even brewed. He'd block one number, another would appear. He'd delete an email, two more would replace it. Most of them sounded like they came from Carrie Farver. But by now, Dave wasn't sure who to believe or trust. The attacks weren't just digital. They were personal, targeted. His garage was broken into. Then his job received anonymous tips about him being violent and abusive. His co-workers were contacted by someone claiming Dave was dangerous. Then Liz, the woman he had once casually dated, told him her home was vandalized again. Spray paint, slashed cushions. One day, she even found a message carved into her wall. "I will destroy you." It was signed, Kari. To police, this looked like the classic case of a mentally unstable ex-girlfriend lashing out. Dave kept providing screenshots, voicemails, and timestamps. But unless Carrie showed up in person, or unless someone got hurt, law enforcement had little to go on. In the eyes of the law, she was just another woman who didn't want to be found. But Dave wasn't so sure anymore. He'd known Carrie, briefly. Yes, but she hadn't struck him as this kind of person. Erratic, emotional maybe, but not dangerous, not this cruel, and certainly not capable of this kind of obsession. Something didn't add up. Carrie's mother, Nancy Rainey, agreed. Her daughter wasn't unstable. Kari was the kind of woman who balanced spreadsheets, raised a teenage son alone, paid bills on time, and sent birthday cards 2 weeks early. She didn't disappear without telling anyone. And yet, Kari had vanished. No more in-person sightings, no bank activity, no ID use, just digital noise. That's all anyone could find. Police labeled her a voluntary missing adult, claiming she'd chosen to vanish, maybe to escape stress or emotional collapse. But Nancy never believed it. She kept calling, kept asking, kept filing reports, and she kept getting the same answer. She's still active online. That's not a missing person. One officer even suggested she wait until Carrie committed a crime. Then, maybe they could open a formal investigation. By the spring of 2013, it had been 6 months since Dave last saw Carrie. And yet, the messages kept coming. Some days, over 60 of them. "I know where you are. You'll never be safe. I'm watching you." And then photos. Pictures of Dave, taken from a distance, at work, in his car, entering his apartment. Someone was surveilling him, daily. He was being hunted, and then the targeting expanded. Amy Flora, Dave's ex-girlfriend and mother of his children, began receiving her own flood of threatening messages. "You should die for getting in the way," one read. "Your children don't deserve a father like him." Her home was broken into, too. Her car keyed. Her children's names were mentioned in several emails. Everything pointed back to one woman, Carrie Farver, but no one could find her. Then, something even stranger happened. Dave received an email from Carrie's address, confessing to stabbing Liz. Yes, stabbing. The message claimed she'd snuck into Liz Goliar's home and attacked her with a knife, stabbing her in the thigh before running off into the night. And yet, Liz never went to the hospital. There were no police reports filed, only photos provided by Liz herself, close-ups of a bloody wound. She said she hadn't reported it because she was afraid Carrie would come back and finish the job. The story didn't make sense, but who was Dave to question it? By then, he was exhausted, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. And Liz, she seemed like the only person who understood what he was going through. After all, she was a victim too. Their casual relationship had faded. But now they leaned on each other. They shared stories, compared emails, supported each other through each wave of harassment. At least that's what Dave believed. But behind the scenes, a much darker game was unfolding. In 2015, nearly 3 years after Carrie's disappearance, the case took an unexpected turn. A cold case detective named Ryan Avis, along with Special Investigator Jim Doty, were assigned to the file. Both men were seasoned, skeptical, and quietly obsessed with puzzles and the Kari Farver file. It was a mess. Thousands of digital messages, no physical sightings, multiple victims. One name repeated over and over, but no actual trace of the woman behind it. To them, this wasn't a case about a missing woman. It was about someone pretending to be her. They began pulling every digital record they could. Emails, IP addresses, login histories. They made charts, timelines, maps. And they noticed something chilling. Most of the messages supposedly from Kari were being sent from Wi-Fi networks connected to one specific individual. Not Dave, not Amy, not Kari, but Liz Golyar, the woman who claimed to be Carrie's biggest victim, was now their prime suspect. Still, there was no proof, no confession, no body. If they were right, Liz had been staging the whole thing, terrorizing Dave and others by impersonating Kari for years. But why? To eliminate competition? To win Dave's affection? Or was it something deeper, more calculated than just jealousy? The investigators knew they had to be careful. They couldn't accuse Liz outright. They needed to catch her in the act. And for that, they were going to play a dangerous game. As Chapter 2 ends, the walls are closing in around Liz Golyar. But she doesn't know it yet. She still believes she's in control, still believes she's smarter than everyone else. But her digital trail is catching up to her. And soon, detectives will find the key that unlocks the full horror of what really happened to Kari Farver. Chapter 3, Smoke, Mirrors, and A, Digital Trail. By 2015, the harassment had gone on for over 3 years. Thousands of emails, messages from dozens of fake profiles, physical threats, fires, vandalism, emotional destruction. Everyone in Dave Krupa's life had suffered. Him, his ex-girlfriend Amy, his co-workers, his children. And in the center of it all was one name, Kari Farver. But behind the curtain, two investigators were quietly undoing the narrative. Detective Ryan Avis and Special Investigator Jim Doty had been combing through gigabytes of digital evidence for months, cross-referencing timestamps, geolocation data, and email headers. They didn't just look at who sent the messages. They looked at where they came from. And one pattern kept repeating. The devices responsible for the harassment were consistently traced back to Liz Golyar's home, her workplace, and her personal phone. That alone wasn't proof. Liz could argue she was being framed, or that someone was piggybacking off her Wi-Fi. But Avis and Doty weren't interested in speculation. They needed a slip-up, a crack, and then Liz made one. One day, Liz reported to police that she had received a disturbing email from Kari Farver. The message detailed the murder of another woman, Dave's ex, Amy. The email included a chilling confession. "I stabbed her and set her on fire." Coincidentally, Liz claimed she'd discovered a burned object near her home. It was a metal container, melted and scorched. She told investigators she believed it had been thrown at her as a warning. Something didn't sit right. The message had a photograph attached, a photo of the burned container. But there was a problem. That same image was found on Liz's phone, not from an email, from her personal gallery. Worse, the timestamp on the image was before she said she received it. It was the first clear evidence that Liz was manufacturing threats and attributing them to Kari. Still, the case needed more. A photo wasn't enough for an arrest. Avis and Doty decided to go deeper. They obtained a warrant to secretly access Liz's phone. What they found turned the entire case. Inside her device, investigators uncovered a treasure trove of damning data, photos of Carrie's vehicle, pictures of a woman tied up, bound with duct tape, meant to resemble a kidnapping. The woman's face was not visible, but the metadata embedded in the images told the truth. These were taken on Liz's phone, in Liz's garage. Then they found drafts, emails that had never been sent, all written from Carrie's perspective, threats, apologies, confessions, dozens of them. In one draft, Liz had even written out a fake confession in which Carrie admitted to ruining everyone's life and saying goodbye before disappearing forever. It was a script, a staged performance of a woman who no longer existed. To Dodie and Avis, it was confirmation. Kari Farver had never been behind any of the threats. She was not the stalker. She was the victim. And the woman who had claimed to be her victim, Shauna Liz Goliar, was the predator. Now, they needed to answer the hardest question of all. What had Liz done to Carrie? They began reviewing the early timeline again. Back in November 2012, Carrie had vanished the day after she spent the night at Dave's apartment. The last confirmed sighting of her was at his place that morning. After that, silence. Then a tidal wave of erratic messages began, starting with the very next day. If Liz was behind the digital impersonation, when and how had Carrie been silenced? Liz had claimed to barely know Carrie, said they only crossed paths once in that hallway, but evidence told another story. Photos recovered from Liz's phone showed Carrie's license plate. Another showed what appeared to be a screenshot of Carrie's Facebook profile, saved weeks after her disappearance. Liz had been watching her, studying her, and, most likely, following her. Dodie and Avis now believed that Liz had lured Carrie somewhere under false pretenses and murdered her shortly after that November morning. Then, for years, she used Carrie's identity to cover up the crime, sending fake messages, hacking into her accounts, and creating the illusion the Kerchekra was still alive. To everyone around her, including Dave, Liz had played the role of protector and fellow victim. But it was all part of her plan. Keep the suspicion off herself. Keep Dave close. And keep Kerr alive, just enough to buy time. But time had run out. The final piece of the puzzle came through Liz herself. Investigators decided to confront her, not with accusations, but with bait. They asked her to help. They told her they were working on the case, and they wanted her opinion about some new evidence. Liz, confident in her ability to control the story, agreed. During the meeting, they played audio recordings, showed her screenshots. They watched her body language shift. One question finally rattled her. "Where were you the morning Carrie disappeared?" Her answer was vague. She said she couldn't remember. Then she said she might have been home. Then she said she might have been shopping. Then she stopped talking. After the meeting, she went home and immediately deleted data from her phone. What she didn't know was that the police were still watching. They were ready. And soon, they'd have what they needed, because somewhere in the ashes of Kari's digital life was the key to bringing Liz down. Chapter 4, The Photo That Changed Everything. By late 2016, nearly 4 years had passed since Carrie Farver vanished. She was still technically alive in the eyes of the system, active on email, posting strange social media messages, sending threats, stalking Dave and Amy, and tormenting Liz. But none of it was real. Behind the keyboard, behind all those accounts, was one person, Liz Goliar, and the net was closing in. Detectives Ryan Avis and Jim Dodie already had digital proof. Liz's devices had been used to send most, if not all, of the threatening messages. They had photo metadata placing her near Carrie's vehicle. They had email drafts she never sent, written from Carrie's perspective. They had motive. They had pattern. They had deception, but they didn't have a body. And without one, there was no murder charge, no formal arrest, just suspicion, and one woman confident enough to keep playing her part until she slipped. It happened on a recovered memory card. Investigators had seized Liz's digital devices, including her cell phones, and a series of SD cards she'd kept in a drawer. One of the cards had been deleted, formatted to look blank. But the tech team knew how to recover wiped data. Deep within the storage, they found a series of images. One was a photo of a decomposing foot, charred, but clearly human. Another showed a leg, a tattoo on the ankle. Investigators recognized the design immediately. A small symbol Carrie Farver's mother had described in her missing person report 4 years earlier. It was the proof they needed. These photos hadn't been downloaded from the internet. They weren't screenshots. They had been taken by Liz's phone and stored on her SD card. That meant one thing. Liz had been in possession of Carrie's body, or at least had access to her remains. It was the breakthrough Doty and Avis had been waiting for. No more pretending, no more uncertainty. Carrie Farver wasn't missing. She had been murdered, and her killer had tried to burn the evidence, then held on to trophies hidden in a digital graveyard. With that evidence secured, the police made their move. In December 2016, Shauna Liz Goliar was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. The news shocked the city of Omaha. To the outside world, Liz had been the victim, the one targeted, the woman who had supposedly endured years of psychological torture at the hands of a violent, unstable stalker. She'd even received sympathy from law enforcement in the early days of the investigation. Now, the truth was out. Liz wasn't the victim. She had orchestrated the entire campaign of terror. It was a performance, meticulously crafted, fueled by obsession and jealousy. And for years, she fooled everyone. But the courtroom would be different. The evidence was damning, digital, and overwhelming. At trial, prosecutors laid out the story for the jury. Liz Goliar had lured Carrie Farver into a trap, likely shortly after Carrie had spent the night at Dave Krupa's apartment in November 2012. Investigators believe Liz confronted her, either at Dave's place or elsewhere. No one knows exactly how the interaction unfolded, but it ended in Carrie's death. From that moment forward, Liz assumed Carrie's identity online, sending messages to Dave, Amy, and even Carrie's own mother. She pretended Carrie was unstable, that she had run away, that she was obsessed with Dave. She vandalized her own property, burned her own garage, stabbed herself, and blamed it all on Carrie. Over time, she deepened the deception, creating fake email accounts, spoofing phone numbers, and fabricating entire conversations between herself and Kari. She even offered to help the investigation, presenting herself as an ally to police. But the photo evidence on her memory card, combined with the digital trail and years of false reports, built an airtight